Welcome to the session, where we're going to hear from Helen Clifford on the first presentation. And Helen's from Keele University and she works in the widening participation. And she's been looking at unique learning numbers, so welcome Helen, thank you.
Thanks for coming everybody. I'm going to be talking about a project that I carried out for the Learning Record Services, which was on the unique learner number, which is the ULN, and the personal learning record, the PLR, and the implications of that on widening participation. So the Learning Record Services are a UK shared services dedicated to improving data sharing and evaluation. They aim to do this through three key products, which are the unique learner number, which is the ULN. That's a 10-digit number which is assigned to every student in learning, in educational training at the age of 14. And there's currently 10.6 million registered. There's also something called a personal learning record, which is a record of verified qualifications and other learning events. And there's currently 6.1 million learners with a PLR at the moment. And then the third one is the UK provider reference number, which is allocated to every recognised learning organisation. So just kind of a quick look at why this work is important for widening participation. There is potential for use with school liaison work, also for the evaluation and impact analysis of outreach and WP work. And overall, there is a national demand for this kind of product or tool to be able to track and use it for other things. So the areas that were considered were around the data sharing issues, mainly between schools and universities or HEIs, so whether the ULN can be passed between them. The use of tracking, using the ULN and the PLR to track learners for longitudinal analysis, and also the implications for retention of students within HE, how the ULN and the PLR can be used in that field. So the first thing is about exploring data sharing issues. As I said, this is between schools and HEIs, and my aim was to investigate whether there are any data protection implications or what kind of agreements would need to be in place to enable this sharing. So I looked at data protection to start with through consultation with the Information Commissioner's Office. They agreed that there was actually nothing in the Data Protection Act which would bar the sharing of the ULN with higher education institutions. And they actually said they would encourage it because their aim is that they support the principle that you should collect data once and use it many times so you don't bother learners asking them for the same information over and over again. The things that I approached them with, the proposed activities, were using the ULN for targeting, using it to contact students for follow-up work, and using it for the tracking of learners, and they agreed that all of those were fine. They did give the kind of caveats that the good practice to follow would be to put in place consent agreements and fully describe what the data is going to be used for and give the option to opt out. It's also probably important to mention at this point that students can access their own PLR and choose who has access to that. So there's another level of control that they've got over their information. So there is nothing in the Data Protection Act which would prevent the sharing of ULNs, but in practice this might be slightly different if schools didn't fully understand the implications or uneasy about sharing their learners' information. So I contacted various schools that we work with as a division, and I found that 70% had heard of the ULN, only 25% had heard of the PLR, 59% of respondents indicated that their schools had the ULMs on file, and 78% gave a positive response to whether they would provide an HEI with student ULMs. So this is quite positive, really. They do know what it is, and they would be willing to share. I then went on to ask them about whether they had concerns over data protection and the sharing of ULMs, and they said the main concern was data protection and how the data would be used. The things that schools said that they would like to see in place were parental consent, assurances over the security of records, assurances that data wouldn't be passed to third parties, description of how the data would be used, and an option to opt out. So this is very similar to what the Information Commissioner's Office advised for kind of aligning with data protection. So that does fit in quite well.
Ellen, is it possible to interrupt you to talk with your eye open?
I don't mind if, yeah, ask.
Just a quick question about consent. I don't really know this area at all. Are we saying the school can give consent to the university just to give them a bunch of numbers? Or do they have to have individual consent from young people? And in terms of young people not being kind of age, is that where the parent relative consent is?
So with data protection, it is a bit of a grey area when it comes to students kind of in their teens. There isn't a fixed age where it's the parent and then becomes the learner. It's defined as when that learner can reasonably make that decision for themselves, and at that point the parent has no say. So it's up to the parent, the school and the student of who has that say. But kind of for your first point, it would be the parent or the student would have to give the consent, and through the school. So the school could make a data sharing arrangement with an HEI, but it would be the school's responsibility to make sure that they had parental consent for each student. Does that answer that question?
Just to add to that is the very reason this sort of green grey area around data protection and young people, and what age are they able to consent to use that data themselves, is the very reason why the Learner Record Service the ULMs aren't issued for the full team, because the data protection stuff got far too messy, so they don't issue it for that age. So that's one of the reasons for it, which is unfortunate for the work that we do in terms of department going on.
And I wasn't sure whether that just a simple number came under the criteria of some of this information.
Definitely would.
Well, we can use that number then to access more information as a user of the Learner Record Service. We are covered, we don't have to sign an agreement with them. But again, it just makes it slightly more sensitive. But we'll get into it a little bit later about the sensitivity. It's not the sort of information that's on the record, which is less, it's not a lot of sensitivity.
Can I just clarify, this is a number that the young person is given in school, and how long does it put us? How that continues?
It stays with them forever.
Forever?
Except not beyond school leaving age, that was the issue. They were always going to make it that it should be from birth virtually right through to HE, but it isn't, and that's where you have this thing.
So
the ideal is that it should have carried with them.
A number of
carries it with them into where?
Whatever they
into
go.
University or
forever.
Wherever they
go. So does it
most,
carry on into university?
A lot of the projects that were being looked at, the most record services at the university, UCAS take the ULM number on the UCAS form, and universities aren't provided it within their data sets when they're provided application information. It's just whether the university's record systems allow for the retainment of that data, and what other universities have been pilot projects onto this programme we're looking at were how universities could use that, both A, for verifying qualifications prior to entry, which is a huge administrative process in institutions, but also for continuing those records on, and you'll see later on in this work sort of how we can use that mainly for tracking.
Okay,
but it is expected to stay with them for life.
I just had a quick question, if it is expected to stay with them for life, at what point does the student themselves revisit the consent issue if parental consent is given in the first place? So if parental consent is for a student who can't give consent or not of age to give consent, but when we start talking about being in the higher ed sector where they are adults, is is there an opportunity to revisit the consent process?
There's always the opportunity for students to log on to Learning Record Services and choose who they want to share
and
it
at
with.
And they can opt out.
Yeah, so they can opt out at any time.
Yeah.
But
okay.
I don't know whether...
How proactive.
Yeah, how often you would want to kind of remind people about that. I think that would be more of a kind of a moral rather than a legal issue.
Well, it's about the ethics of consent, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. So we found that the ULN, the schools would be happy to pass that on. So I then went on to see whether in practice this actually would happen. So with a few projects that we run, I requested the ULN as part of our normal data collection on learners, and found that only 26% of the schools return the ULN. So in practice, it doesn't really match up to what the schools are saying. And in fact, some schools don't return any data at all, so that's another issue that WP practitioners could have in trying to access this information. Okay, so the next area to look at was the tracking of learners for longitudinal analysis and the potential that the ULN and the PLR could have to track learners through the activities that they take part in. So the first thing to do with this was to actually obtain the ULN. So if you've got information such as the name, gender, date of birth and postcode, you have to do an upload to the Learning Record Services. So obviously if you've got the ULN from the school, it's fine. Often you might not have that information. So you have to upload this information as a one big file, then you get the ULNs back. So I did this for a sample which was 202 records, and found only 41% returned with the ULNs. This obviously has huge implications for doing huge uploads if you're only getting under half of them back. Found that 43% of the remainder returned as possible matches, but actually 98% of those ones, so basically all of those possible matches, only had one possible match, and they had to be manually confirmed. So what that means is that, for example, in our database, the middle name might have been included with the first name, which would mean it's slightly different, or the postcode might be slightly different, kind of a zero and a naught kind of swapped around. That means it's not exactly the same as in the Learner Record Service database. It comes back as a possible match, which you have to manually confirm. But I had a look at the information that came back, and I think that around 75% return would be more feasible if the kind of the real data cleansing took place, so you knew that your postcodes were correct and you knew that you didn't have shortened first names, or you knew you didn't have the middle names included. So from this, I took a sample of the personal learning records to see what information was actually on there, and the only fields that were populated were those key ones, which you should need anyway to get the ULN. The other fields, such as qualification data and information about the schools, was less frequently populated.
Can I ask a question? Who's responsible for completing it? Who puts the data
out? The Learning Record Service have a relationship with all the national qualification providers, and so they provide that data. And one of the reasons why the fields that we were accessing for the PLR were not accessed, because we were accessing, I think it was summer school learners from
2007.
So they were, I think the year before, they'd started putting in that data. So again, data is taking time to catch up, so it's only learners that have been issued their ULN in 2010, say, that all their qualification data is going to be on their records. So it's going to take a number of years for those records to even be of use, which is really what we discovered in this pilot. But it's the Learning Record Service is a national service, and they're responsible for the data in that, but the data in it that it contains, it is supposed to contain basic key data information,
okay.
Here
and, they felt,
and their qualifications.
So
and
who puts in the qualifications?
The qualification, the
awarding body.
Sorry,
puts
yeah.
in, so the awarding body, sorry, the Learned Record Service would complete the initial data, and awarding bodies would add to that as the young person gained
yeah.
qualifications. Right?
Yeah.
It's just we don't have that service here. That's fine.
Yeah, that's what's happening.
Okay.
And I think there is explorations of that here in Scotland as well. In Manchester.
We've not gone down there.
So the qualifications body to put the information, but what happens? So does the learner have any control over whether those records are correct or not?
This is what some of the other institutions were piloting over. They were looking at using it as a way of verifying, say, for example, GCSE English and maths on applications and those sorts of things. And they were looking at a lot of the details of that. And what they found was that the learner can access it and question it. What Newcastle had done in their massive pilot was to basically say, right, we can pull your qualifications from your personal learning record directly into your Newcastle application, at which point a learner can then change what comes up on their Newcastle application. And then with what the university gets at the other end of the Newcastle application is, this is a learner record verified qualification, so verified by the body, and this one can be changed by the applicant. So you would then require them to bring in the certificate or the change, because sometimes you would have issues. If, so for example, a learner had appealed their result and that had been changed, that might not have been updated in time. And as this service develops, the time of update is getting a lot quicker. So at the moment, you're looking at awarding bodies confirming all their results in August with institutions, but that doesn't update on the system straight away. So that's too late for the university admissions processes, but they are speeding up that process year on year now, and working with the awarding bodies to make that a live process. So it's actually universities will be able to use it in the future as a way of getting the verified results for their applicants.
It's been quite clear, actually, just as a quick question. Canada has some states that want to have a custody.
Going
to remain firm, some part of somebody's record will be firmly retained by somebody. Sounds very big brotherish to me, you know. It's a whole question out there. Who else will have access? I'm just, my mind is burning thinking of go to the supermarket. They know most of my shopping habits already. When you start at a young age, you're collecting your data right through your life.
This is a central data only currently in qualification records, and I think.
No, I understand. I was going to sometimes, I just wonder
yeah.
who else might have access in years to come.
A marketing group, you might want to know everybody who has certain.
Absolutely, there is a number of agreements that the Learning Record Service have about that data, but I think that's a whole different debate over data.
So my question is, so can I, if I was on there, say, look, I want my record deleted?
You could say that you don't want it shared with anybody at all.
You can remove your consent and say you don't want to share your
information,
but I think to say that any data is ever deleted or destroyed is slightly valued statement. Dealing with the Criminal Record Bureau, for example,
I understand.
Thank you.
So the problem was that quite a lot of these fields are actually not populated, and the other issue is that it's actually you have to access each PLR individually, so you can't do a bulk upload of the personal learning records. You have to look at each one. So if you were using this for tracking, that would have some time implications for the resource to be able to do all of that. As we've kind of mentioned, that there is only this basic information and qualification data on the PLR. So I moved on to recommend what other fields would be useful. So I did this through a stakeholder questionnaire, and the information that practitioners would like to see on the PLR includes demographic information such as ethnicity, disability and in-care information, widening participation information such as family history of HE and NSSEC, educational history such as predicted grades and academic potential, participation in activities and attitudes to HE. Also, that I don't think are on there, but free school meals, EMA, well, maybe not now, socioeconomic class, and 84%, as I asked, view the ULM and PLR positively, thought it would be a good tool for people to use. So the final thing that I looked at was the potential for the ULN and PLR to be used in retention. So the potential for it to identify at-risk students and then to target interventions that were specific to them. So the reasons why students drop out varies hugely, and there can be many contributing factors. However, there are some general reasons that can influence retention. So these include the mode of study, the institute studying at, the subject studied, pre-entry qualifications, social and economic backgrounds, gender, age and disability. So the PLR could be used to identify these at-risk students, so students that fall under the vulnerable end of these categories. And then if you know why they're vulnerable, for example, because of their gender or because of particular qualifications that they've got, you can put into place the correct intervention. So it's not just an intervention that's for everyone, it's an intervention that's tailored for particular groups, which will hopefully be much more successful. And also you're not kind of doing a scattergun approach, you're kind of really tailoring it, which could save resources and have a lot more impact as well. The other way that the PLR could be useful is to record academic credits. So if a student did want to withdraw from university, that if their credits were recorded on their PLR, if they did return to HE at a different institution or wherever they want to carry on, this could enable the transfer of those credits and the continuation of their studies. Okay, so in summary, the ULN and PLR have many potential uses in the work of learning participation, and the tracking of learners using the ULN could aid the evaluation work of institutions and hopefully provide more robust impact analysis. It could also impact upon the university student cohort profile, retention and progression rates, and ultimate outcomes of learners. And ways to move forward would be developing the ways that ULNs are shared between schools and HEIs, investigating the kind of practicalities of obtaining the ULNs, whether it's through the Learning Record Service or through student data from schools. And also expanding what data is included and populated in the PLR. Any more questions that want to ask? Yeah.
Could I just say, because nowhere on there did I see connections, because obviously in AMHIR, some AMHIR areas are working with connections and use their databases, and also it's probably not relevant now, but we had an agreement with our local authority in Cumbria. I get their data and they could processing notice, but that isn't what I work now. It's going to become academies, because as soon as school became academies, that was it. Their data doesn't go to the local authority, it's straight to the YPLA. So I think from our point of view, you know, I don't know about individual schools. We find it easier to work with the local authority, because then it's just one hit you do. And actually, by putting that on there for your processing notice, I'm not sure the parents particularly understood, but they explained what was happening to the data, and it would only be shared for, you know, evaluation purposes, and people would never be identified. But obviously NSSEC and so on, schools don't have. And my local authority got ACORD, so we had ACORD 4 and 5, and that's the way of identifying low participation neighbourhoods, because they call it high-rise hardship or something. But that's hugely flawed as well. And I mean, I think there's great potential in this unique learner number, but I feel that if your academies, if they're going the way ours are, they don't want, you know, they don't want to share their data, so it becomes really tricky. So I think we had always said with the Department for Education, whatever it was called, that they needed do it themselves. They needed to have this number carried through and provide the data for us instead of us going out individually trying to get it from somebody.
Can I just ask you, we need to draw this presentation to a close because of time. I'm sure there'll be lots more questions and that people will be wanting to ask Helen. And can we just thank you for your presentation? Thank you to Rina and John to do a comparative study of two universities and from University of Northampton.
And
you.
Okay. Which side do you want to stand?
I'll stand here.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks for coming to the second half of the session. Thanks for an interesting first half. I thought I'd just introduce us first, then quickly go through my structure for this, and then get into the nitty-gritty. So my name's John Rose Adams, I work for the Open University. We have a Centre for Inclusion and Curriculum that produces a curriculum-wide programme of access modules. We're also responsible for a lot of the research about widening participation and inclusion at the Open University. So that's what I'm heavily involved in. This is Rohini.
Hello. My role at the University of Northampton is the widened participation coordinator. I recognise the Northampton link. And Dr. John Butcher, who's also involved in this research, is the senior academic advisor at the University of Northampton. So he leads really on teaching and learning activities, CPD, and oversees equality and diversity, partnerships, and widening participation.
So we've got quite a breadth of experience both in curriculum areas, more kind of like traditional, let's say, widening participation activity, and two very different institutions. And that's kind of part of the reason about this project. So what I'm going to do is just quickly explain what we were trying to get at and how we structured the project. The strand that we're going to try and draw out about outreach and aim high legacy, which is one of the themes of this conference, and then get into our findings, and hopefully then we'll start for a big discussion. I've not heard the white paper talked about so far as much as I thought I was. So if we're all keen, we'll really get into that as well, because I think some of the findings we've got have relevance. So our project, our overall research project, it's wider than what we're going to talk about today. But we, based on an informal conversation really, realised that our two universities, as different as they are, were both heavily involved in reviewing their current widening participation strategies. Obviously we're doing so at a time, and we're talking earlier this year, trying to second guess government policy and waiting for some kind of indication about what we're going to have to do. Both universities are also looking very, very, very closely at their finances and trying to restructure and try and keep ahead of the game. So we thought best a good time to do some research of this type. We then tried to work out how best to pursue such things, and we decided let's go to the top. So we talked specifically to our senior strategic responsible officers in respective institutions. So those people have responsibility for generating widening participation strategy, and obviously everything comes with that, translating policy, linking it to mission, and also being responsible for its success, its measuring it, and so forth. So we pursued a wide range of questionnaires, which obviously we're going to focus on this one. But they were all very interlinked. The conversations that we had with our senior leaders were very... you can guess that outreach, aim higher, however you want to call it, is heavily implicated in all other areas of this kind of stuff. I think in our findings, the most interesting discussion that hopefully we can have with you today is about impact and value for money. And for our aim higher colleagues in the room, I'm really interested in kind of, as we move forward into a new phase, issues that I've heard fall for the last couple of days about legacy, built up knowledge, moving it forward, putting it into institutions, how really that's going to work, and the white paper. So, bring
Okay, just to remind or give a little bit of context, I think one of the questions that came up in our research is, are we on the cusp of a change in terms of a golden age of WP passing and a more austere age coming? So in 1997, when the new Labour government came in, what we saw in universities was a really generous availability of resources to support a national widened participation strategy, coupled with the expansion of HE student numbers. What was interesting was that targeted funding has always recognised that you need money both for outreach and retention, and each of the four administrations in the UK have got devolved responsibility for this, so we have divergent approaches. And of course in England we were trying for a target of 50% participation. If you look at where we are now, so if you think about 2010, the formation of the coalition government, I think everyone would recognise the kind of headlines that have been fueling debate in the higher education sector. So cuts of up to 80% in the teaching grant, a shift from public funding to private funding through the trebling of student fees, and a termination of funding for access and outreach networks, so lifelong learning networks, AIM Higher networks. What we wanted to do as well was just to explore the idea that widened participation is actually a very complex term and differently understood by different people, but it also has links with a whole lot of other agendas which similarly are not particularly clearly defined. So for example, inclusion in a generic way can be used to describe the process of including people from a variety of underrepresented groups, but sometimes is used to refer specifically to the inclusion of people with disabilities. Diversity is often relating to the different characteristics, the protected characteristics of diversity groups, but some people use to refer diversity to ethnic diversity or socioeconomic diversity. Equality, I think, has more of a link with the legislative framework, so the requirement under equality legislation for universities to do work around race, gender, disability. And then if we think about equity, that's more a term that's used in Australia, which again is talking about work with disadvantaged groups, so indigenous people, people from different socioeconomic backgrounds, and people with disabilities. We've got questions against all of these, because another word that we kept coming across in debates around widening participation was the idea of enhancement. So is widening participation ultimately about enabling students to be better students, to achieve well, to fulfil their potential? And then we've got social justice. And I was thinking, actually, one of the debates we've had throughout this conference is whether issues of social justice, social mobility, are the new nomenclature. So maybe widening participation will disappear as a term. Okay, what we wanted to do is to just give you a feel for how contrasting the two institutions are. So the Open University gained degree awarding powers in 1970. It's unique in being the only UK university dedicated to distance learning. It has 150,000 undergraduates, which I find mind-blowing, and 30,000 postgraduates. 70% of their students are in full-time employment. 20% study from outside the UK. 10% are black and minority ethnic. And 7% have a declared disability. Of course, it could be much higher. The mode of delivery that is central to OU courses is e-learning, blended with support from regional centres. Interestingly, at the OU, they've recently had a new Vice-Chancellor who brings with him significant international business experience. And the mission of the Open University, which I'm sure you'll all recognise, is to promote social justice through an open access policy. So there's no requirement for minimum educational qualifications. John, is there anything you want to add?
No, that's better than I could have done.
Yeah. Okay, in complete contrast, the University of Northampton, very new university, we only gained degree awarding powers in 2006. Our mission is very much about transforming lives and inspiring change. We were delighted recently in the Guardian University League tables to be ranked first for added value. So in all the other league tables, we come about 100 out of 133 universities, but the Guardian actually looks at what qualifications students come in with and the journey they've travelled, the distance they've travelled with us. We have 14,000 full-time equivalent students, 42% of who are mature, and the definition of mature is over 21. 28% of our learners are part-time, 25% black and minority ethnic, and that's interesting because in Northampton it's only around 7%, so we attract a lot of students from urban areas like Birmingham, Midlands and London, and 7% with a declared disability. The way we're organised is that we have 6 academic schools, and we work a lot with 4 strategic partner further education colleges. And those further education colleges offer a number of foundation degree subjects. Similarly to the Open University, we had a new Vice-Chancellor who joined us in September last year. And with him is coming a huge amount of change. So we have a new strategic business plan called Raising the Bar. We have new metrics, key performance indicators everywhere. Glad to say access is in there, but we're having more of a debate about some of the others. But also what he's doing is identifying social enterprise as the unique selling point for our university. And the way that this will play out is that for all students that come to us from October this year, they will get the chance to work in a social enterprise, either one the university has set up, one that exists in the community, or one they have the idea for setting up. So that's about developing entrepreneurial skills, employability skills from day one. A second aspect of social enterprise will be orienting all research activity across the academic schools to look at the links between the discipline and social enterprise. And the third thing is looking at the regional regeneration, social and economic regeneration, through working with local authority partners, so the county council and borough councils.
One final more contextual slide before we can get to the fun stuff. How we're currently set up to do outreach. The Open University has a kind of a more tangential relationship with AIM Higher programmes, although it's a host organisation to AIM Higher Greater Manchester. That's kind of an accommodation arrangement. But the Open University is present in AIM Higher's partnerships around the UK. But because of its focus on mature age students as an institution, it has its own outreach programme, which it now calls a community partnerships programme. And that's focused on communities in deprivation, which we measure in a variety of wonderful ways. University of Northampton, kind of a contrast, obviously through its AIM Higher work, focusing on school-age students, but also an increasing focus on mature age students. I'd probably add that the OU is increasingly interested in younger students because its profile is shifting towards the younger. Both, you'd be not surprised or pleased to hear, share in common an evidence-led focus and targeting of outreach resources to varying levels of focus and target. And we're going to talk about that in a little bit as well. Okay. Check it out. Literature review in one slide. Okay. There's a limited literature about how institutions respond to widening participation agendas, roughly split. There's thematic work, which is quite often stuff that's funded by HEFCE and Action on Access, and John Storan has been heavily involved in those ones. And they've been very thematic, but generally coming out with issues about how implementation is problematic within institutions, and this issue of turning, making action from rhetoric within institutions. Then there's a more discursive strand, and Paul Greenbank, Jacqueline Stevenson have been doing some really good work around that, which is more interrogating kind of really what it means to be using the rhetoric of widening participation at an institutional level. And Paul Greenbank's work focused a lot on comparing our Russell Group universities with our post-1992 universities, our former polytechnics as well. and Jacqueline Stevenson's work was really getting into the nitty-gritty of institutional case studies and seeing, just demonstrating the wide variety of interpretation that a unified institution can have in terms of what it understands widening participation to be. So we position ourselves sort of like happily amongst that bunch. And I appreciate that as a very truncated view of literature, but you've got to do it because it's a slide. And our methodology, quite important, I hope. The important thing amongst all this, and I'll let you read that, is that we are set up differently to deliver widening participation. Northampton deliver their strategy through their deans, their discipline-orientated widening participation at a senior level. The Open University does the opposite. It is almost fully outside its faculties and does it through its Equality and Diversity Unit, its units for widening participation, which the unit I work in is. Our student services, which is wholly separate from our faculties, our students are owned by a director of student services, not by faculties, although that is slightly changing. So we've pursued this comparative case study with that proviso. These are different people, and our findings will demonstrate what that actually means in terms of widening participation strategy. And then you get some technical stuff. They're all telephone or face-to-face, digitally recorded. Research transcribed, and we did some separate and then some joint analysis. So we developed our own themes, compared and developed broad overview themes. Okay. So findings relating to outreach and AIMHI. We've got three main things that we just wanted to kind of explore with you. And these are still like kind of emerging ideas really, so I'd be interested in your perspectives. Red quotes, University of Northampton, blue quotes, Open University. We've used a lot of quotes, so we need to kind of like give them some distance on the slides. The first, I think, important issue that we could see very clearly was that everyone we spoke to had within themselves a clear commitment to a widening participation agenda, however they decided to formulate that in their own heads. They usually linked it to their institution's mission, but importantly, because people have written about this, we didn't feel, and we can honestly say this, we didn't feel it was simply putting across the party line. I didn't feel any and Rohini did in her interviews, any sense that people were just saying it because they were being recorded and they felt they should. These were genuinely felt beliefs, which is a good thing. And there's obviously, from all the work that Liz Thomas says, if you've got the senior institutional buy-in, in theory, that's one of your tick boxes and you're away. The difference is then, underlying that though, the University of Northampton, we found there's divergent perspectives on the value of AIMHI and outreach work. And as the deans sort of expressed their views, there became different ideas about who you should be targeting. And not necessarily related to discipline specific things like STEM agendas and things like that. There was just different ideas about where we'd go. At the OU, different approach, there was a barrier that all of our senior leaders put in front of their own ideological commitment, which was, yeah, well, if we've got no money, we're not going to do it. And that came across very strongly, and we were kind of surprised that they could be that honest. So we got an indicative quote there about being, unless we're really strapped for cash and had to make some hard choices. There's a lot of provisos there. The OU is strapped for cash, and it is making hard choices. So what happens to outreach? My collective point, I think, is about achieving consensus. These divergent views aren't productive in terms of a widening participation strategy for an institution. If these are the senior group that are writing a strategy and there is divergent views on what is valuable and what is attainable with money, then they're not going to have a very good strategy necessarily. And there's also a strong theme at the institutions to take a role in efficiency and focus. So both institutions spoke about how in the University of Northampton's case it's AIMHI and bringing in-house AIMHI type activity. One of their quotes of almost challenging them, but okay, we're going to offer 60% of that funding and give them a 7% chance. Can they do it with less? That kind of Bruce will kind of like, yeah, okay, but you're going to have to work a lot harder. You know? At the OU, there was a different kind of perspective, and it was that they're already on a good strong way to evaluating to death the efficiency of their outreach. What senior leaders felt at the OU was that we were already sufficiently doing it. I don't think that's necessarily factually right, accurate, but they certainly are on their way to identifying, you know, where the return on investment is in this kind of work. Obviously, from my previous point, this heavy looking at return on investment, value for money, that is because the money's not there. So they really can't think that hard. So it's not necessarily this altruistic, like, let's really low, you know, make sure that we're getting the best out of this. It's more, is this worth it? And one of the other findings I wanted to talk about is the relevance of the curriculum. I think we all appreciate one of the key strands of widely participation work is not just getting people in, but it's looking at what's offered to students, how it's delivered, and obviously the curriculum is a key point in that. Again, there's a difference. In the OU, there was divergent evaluation of how well the institution performs in terms of diversity. We're quite polar opposites. I mean, but these are people that sit next to each other in senior leadership meetings and have very different views about how well an institution performs. So a nice exchange between the interviewee and the interviewer there at the top about going to a graduation ceremony and not seeing any cultural mix. And so, well, that tells you a lot, doesn't it? Versus another, you know, Bessie May on the senior management table, who basically is honestly, you know, reports wonderful diversity, covering all the socioeconomic patterns, taps into a very diverse group of people. And who's right? At the University of Northampton, a different kind of divergence in the value of diversity within the curriculum. And these quotes, I think, are probably worth reading out if you don't mind. So we've got a view at the top, a curriculum which focuses on the learning outcomes of the needs of students, as well as who has diversity of outputs, and learning outcomes are flexible enough to accommodate to a range of students' abilities and ways of work. Yes, tick. That's right. Versus another dean who sees diversity as problematic. If you have everything in there, it is so broad and wide, there is no depth in terms of knowledge base, no content. We can get workshops about employability, internationalisation, foreign language, the depth of English stuff, social community development, like volunteering, you end up with something so watered down. He's basically shot down everything that is related to this kind of work. So hugely different views. And again, this is, we're talking about a group of the same strata of senior leadership in it. Both our interviewees were very clearly of the view that the high-level data is still the important stuff. The four key measures that we refer to, and they'd be like recruitment, retention, progression, achievement, and employability as a kind of like a mini thing. But there was interesting perspectives on actually why we do that. A University of Northampton quote there about how you how actually just being forced to measure stuff is in itself able to create change. So although this obsession with high-level measures persists, people have different views on actually what that means and why we do it. But the other strand was that, in many ways, kind of a polar opposite, and both again in the University of Northampton's responses and the OU's, was about student measures of success and the importance of that. And we're talking before the white paper came out, which, you know, on the face of it, is all about students measuring and challenging the system. And an obsession almost in the responses about how we need to make systematic use of additional quantitative data. And also a consciousness from the interviewees about the conflicts that means. Insistence on new national measures and of the broad quantitative measures. Increasing levels of student scrutiny because of increasing fees this kind of commoditization of university education. And also this conflict with providing meaningful management of data. So there's a quote there from one of the OU interviewees about notwithstanding all the benefits of looking at students' view of impact for them, the fact that it's qualitative means that it's not going to get looked at senior management teams. So, and this is a senior manager talking, so an absolute proponent of qualitative stuff saying it's not going to get listened to though, at the meetings are now. So there you go. Okay, some brief conclusions and then hopefully we've got time for chat.
I'll just gallop through this really quickly. I mean, you won't be surprised to hear that what came out from all those interviews and our analysis was the fact that impact, evidence and evaluation, we wanted more. And in terms of impact, it was impact at different levels. We wanted stories about individual impact. We wanted stories about impact at the institutional level. In terms of evidence, we wanted evidence from a range of stakeholders. In terms of evaluation, we wanted analysis and critical reflection. And I think using a balance of quantitative and qualitative was required to actually answer questions about, you know, are we getting a good return on investment for the money that's going into WP? And I think that very much reflects this greater emergence of a business environment around this. In terms of mainstreaming WP, what we found was that it had to be central to the institutional mission, but actually just having the words in the policy wasn't enough, that the university had to identify with it in its culture. You had to have not just buy-in, but really active buy-in, so leaders walking the talk, that it was important to have those discussions to try and lead to more consensus and clarity, because otherwise you had an organisation that was pulling in lots of different directions and energy was being dissipated. But even if you've got all of those things in place, there is something about translating policy into practice that is very muddy and things get lost or changed on the way. And I guess in a way what we feel is happening at the moment is as resources get more tight and we're entering an age of austerity, we are being challenged to come up with creative solutions. So one of the things that's happening with Aim High in Northamptonshire is that they are also thinking of setting up as a social enterprise, which kind of fits well because that's the university's USP. But I think it's a really evolving time. And of course, universities are under responsibility to carry on with outreach. We don't have the same expertise necessarily with all the groups, and we have capacity issues. So we are now looking at how can we work creatively in a way that is a win-win for both Aim Higher and for the university. We'd really welcome any comments or questions.
Or discussions, reflections on your own institution.
I'm not sure whether you mentioned this at the start, sorry if I missed it, but I was just wondering how the two universities ended up working together on this project.
It was an informal contact.
I was going to lie and say it was a highly, I mean, Milton Keynes and Northampton are close to each other. It was an informal contact to start with. But I think it was in the discussions the fact that we realised that our strategy renewal dates were identical, and that we've been talking about how differently we do stuff. Well, the stuff about institutional response doesn't necessarily consider how the frameworks that are set up to deliver device strategy and deliver what we anticipate kind of affect how it's done and its successes. So the fact that we did it so differently was to us pretty tantalising. So let's grill the senior management and see what they think. So I think that's why we did the formal contact. Best way to start a research.
I'm just interested. Thank you for that. It's that I always have this feeling, because all I work for Abigail's very much involved with the entire institution was concerned with it. I've got this feeling that the traditional university to buy in this concept, and I think there was a lot of concern, because if you look at the Russell Group of Southern Universities, they don't need to do this, and they have, each time they go out, they get 2 A's, 2 3 B's, they don't talk, and that level of confidence that gets in that the pass rate will be constant or increased. Whereas if you're getting students with these sort of the depths of social society, if you like, are not actually particularly capable in terms of funding a degree. Therefore, feel our standards have to drop to accommodate the students. Is that getting a feeling that people don't think, why do we need to evaluate them constantly? Do the same level of evaluation on students coming from the mainstream, if you like, and see if there's a difference?
Is anyone here from Russell Group University?
He's not going to say.
I'm based in Russell Group University, but I can represent university.
I think you'd be well placed to reflect a bit. Russell Group University and Paul Greenbank's research was very much focused on this disconnect between, all institutions have to engage in widening participation. They have done for the last 10 years. A constant theme is actually when you don't need to, when you're research intensive, when you can pick the cream of the crop, what is widening participation? The interesting thing that the coalition government understand, their definition of widening participation has vocalised in their outreach, the brightest young kids to the most elite universities. Their rhetoric isn't elite universities are bad, quite the opposite. Elite universities are brilliant, so let's get the bright parts, a Dickensian kind of view of these things. These grubby little kids that are geniuses into these things. And that works for Russell Group universities because it says it's kind of the only way they know to respond to widening participation. For other universities, teaching intensive universities.
It would be interesting as well when you're looking at Russell Group universities to see how well their student recruitment departments and their widening participation departments work together. And I'm not saying anything other than that, but it would be interesting to see what the relationship is between the two.
I know University of Liverpool have.
I'm not saying anything else.
No.
Andrew, you have a question?
I was just interested to know whether you felt other very different organisations, different missions, et cetera, what you could actually learn from each other in terms of reflecting on and improving.
I think for us, it was just really useful to have a completely different mirror to hold up your practice against. Because I almost think if we'd done it with another, more similar university, it might have become a competition. But I think because the characteristics were so different, obviously one of the things we're looking at, like a lot of universities are increasing internationalisation, and that's something that the OU is also looking at. So there were points of commonality. I think what it's actually done for us is to make us think much more clearly about whether we want to be a university that specialises in a particular area of the market, because that's one thing that the OU have done really, really well. And there's a feeling that maybe at Northampton and a lot of other universities, we're trying to be all things to all people, and maybe we need to have the guts to say, actually, this is the part of the market we're going to serve, and believe that they'll come to us because we'll excel in that. But it's that debate hasn't been concluded. But I think just the contrast has thrown up lots of questions for us.
Just one, I'm curious to hear a bit more about why we see as chosen enterprise as a vehicle. And what does the BC see as the advantage of pinning so much on social enterprise? I mean, there's the School for Social Entrepreneurs, which has got a fantastic reputation, but not perhaps a broad recruitment to generally people who have got to a state in that background to go and study.
What I've heard, my impression is that it's because of the changes in the public sector. So if you think about the amount of staff that are being let go, services are going to have to be delivered in a very different way. And that has been identified as an opportunity. And because our university has always been about making knowledge work, improving the local community, I think he sees social enterprise as something that works for students in terms of helping them with employability. It works with our regional remit, and it also works as a way of unifying the whole university. I have to say to you that there is quite a fierce debate. Some of the academic schools are really not happy about having this imposed. And at the moment, the work that's going on is to try and work out, is this something that will really add value to the work that they want to do, the kind of research they want to undertake? Will it contribute to our teaching and learning? And we're very, very early on. I mean, this new strategy came in October 2010.
That's
an interesting debate.
You've advertised for a social entrepreneur
we've got
a person or something. That advert looked like you wanted
serious
and
everything, absolutely. Yeah. Did you actually find somebody that was perfect?
I've not heard whether they appointed. I know.
When that was an amazing job description.
Yeah. But also, what they've done is they've.
Well, that's what I was thinking.
Also, what they've done is they've appointed a social entrepreneur for the town of Corby. So that's quite an interesting approach, taking a locality approach, because it's an area with lots of social problems. What they're saying is, in the past, it's this thing about agencies not being able to work in a joined up way. But actually, if you had one person with this kind of social entrepreneur brief, they could work with all the organisations. I mean, I think at one level, I'm really excited by the level of ambition. But it is quite scary because, like you say, all the colours are being nailed to this mast. And you don't actually know.
It's also the stuff of the big society, isn't it? Because as I know, I was in London, actually jumping into this pot of money which might be available in the future and looking very seriously.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the other things I should say, one of our very senior members of staff got the Queen's Enterprise Award. And I think that started a whole lot of interest in enterprise education. So I think there were a number of strands that came together, but we have to wait and see. It's an evolving agenda.
Okay. I'm just interested in the timescales, if you like, because I can see a lot of synergy in what we've been through, this whole introduction of new leadership and a new Vice-Chancellor, and I kind of think if I'd ask questions about what they thought about the development and the strategy, etc., 10-11 months ago when he first arrived, the answers I would get now were very different because that leadership has a chance of an effect. So I'm just interested in the timescales of introductions in the new VCs and institutions and the timing of your research. So what's the, because I think sometimes the impact of that new leadership takes a good at least 12 months, and I think that's being short with it, to embed, and you don't start hearing, so it gives an interesting perspective to the responses you might get.
I mean, I think for us, the new Vice-Chancellor joined in September 2010, and these interviews were carried out in May 2011, so within his first year. For us, what's been really interesting is we've got a big restructuring going on, and I think actually raising these issues, it was quite useful to see where his thinking was coming from. But I agree with you. I think if we talk to him a few months down the line, you'd get different answers, partly because he's been around the institution, talked to more people, seeing what's happened nationally as well. But in some senses, whatever research you do of this nature can only ever be a snapshot. So I think it's a good cautionary note. You know, that was what was happening sort of May, and not to assume that that's a static response.
That's great. I mean, we were conscious that there would be a snapshot, and we thought what a good snapshot. This is utter, you know, people just banging around in a vacuum, effectively, but developing strategy. OU's Vice Chancellor was 2009. He spent a long time embedded, but he's now in full steam ahead. He's from Microsoft and Novell, Thomson, massive organisations, so he's like a steamroller. So things just change overnight. But he's given evidence to bids and select committees about why he participated specifically, so it's clearly
Can I just ask you to thank John and Rowena for their very stimulating presentation. I've got loads of questions, but we've run out of time, and I'll catch up with you later. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.